Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
In a sudden flash, it all comes clear. It's a eureka moment, an epiphany. Hi, I'm Marcus Smith, host of the Constant Wonder podcast. The world offers marvel, meaning, and mystery around every single corner. In nature, art, science, culture, history, we talk everything from bees and beetles to obelisks and asteroids. Experience the thrill of transformative encounter. We'll bring more wonder to your day.
Listen to Constant Wonder wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. Alina has been on the hunt for more ancient stuff. Who's with us today, Alina?
We've got Howard Williams, who is a medieval archaeologist, a professor at the University of Chester, and a published author. He specialises in the archaeology of death, burial, and commemoration, and we're going to be talking about exactly that today. Hi, Howard.
Hello, how are you doing?
Oh, this is brilliant. I like the way we're pretending we haven't just been chatting for the last half hour before we started. And then we were like, oh, have we got a podcast to record?
Very much so.
This is brilliant because, like, archaeology, everything is dead, so it's kind of logical. But then when you read the questions we're going to put to you today, it's not really logical, is it? So I'm really excited to learn stuff today.
Yeah.
But let's start with what sounds like a really obvious, stupid question. Why do we dig up the dead?
Yeah, it's a really, it's the biggest question. Actually, the first point I always say as a proviso is that mortuary archaeology, the archaeology of death, isn't simply about digging up bodies or graves, but that's a huge part of what we do. We also look at above ground, look at cemetery spaces, memorials, mausolea, tombs, you know, and the funerary landscapes of past society. So it's not all about digging up the dead, but why do we dig up the dead? Well, today, in today's world, we try and avoid it, where unless it's actually legitimate, we have a good question we need to ask of that particular period or cemetery, or in most cases, most mortuary archaeology is being done in commercial excavations ahead of development. So you'll be aware, or listeners will be aware of the big case studies of recent times, like Crossrail, HS2, where obviously we're ploughing massive lines through the landscape, and you know we're excavating everything in its way, and that will take up Neolithic Bronze Age cemeteries right the way up to 19th century Victorian cemeteries and churchyards. So, in other words, today we dig up the dead when otherwise it would be lost knowledge, it would be destroyed, it will be lost to everyone, and there's no way around it unless we want to have no more development at all. And of course that's a whole issue that archaeologists therefore find ourselves on either side of debates about development. And the other big case study where archaeologists find them on side either side is Stonehenge at the moment, where some of my archaeology pals and colleagues are going, stop the Stonehenge tunnel, and others are going, yeah, it's all right, let's do that. In the present day, we have, we are trying to be responsible and only excavate graves when it's absolutely necessary. But historically, this has been meat and potatoes for archaeologists since the Renaissance. You know, that we've excavated tombs out of just sheer interest, and it's the very foundation of archaeology around the globe, including its imperial and colonial dimensions of basically going to other countries, missionizing societies, digging up their local cemetery, and putting the stuff in museums. So it's such an integral part of the history of archaeology. But today, obviously, we try and, with our battery of scientific techniques, we try and be much more responsible about when and how we excavate graves.
I mean, you've already touched on this, but can you properly define for us what mortuary archaeology is? Lay it out for us as if we had no idea what you were talking about.
Well, often I have no idea what I'm talking about, but I'll try my best anyway. So, I mean, the way I would define it in broadest terms, it's the study of human relationships between the living and the dead in time. And that is usually seen as times past. You know, the whole of human history and prehistory, and the study of our human relationships with death and the dead, disposal of the dead, commemoration of the dead, and relationships with religious systems, social structures, but it's also about our present and our future, because mortuary archaeology takes us right up to the study of our present death ways and looking at the material cultures and landscapes of death today, and also our plans for the future. There's hardly a cemetery around that's full, and there's massive debates about the future of how we deal with the dead. And so part of what we're increasingly doing as mortuary archaeologists is using our information from the past to try and discuss and inform where we're going with our relations with the dead, particularly in the digital age. But in short, I would say mortuary archaeology is the study of human relationships with mortality. That's the way I would put it in the broadest terms.
I love some of the things you've mentioned already that you are into. We have to get into this as we get further along in this chat, but let's start with the obvious one. What can a burial tell us about a person or people?
See, I like this question, the way you phrase that, because burials, by definition, never tell us about the person that's in that burial. You know, another proviso, I just want to, you know, I'm an academic, so I have to do lots of provisos. So a lot of points is we're not always just finding people in graves. Yeah. We're often finding cenotaphs or poorly preserved fragments of a person, cremated remains, you know, and remains that have been exhumed or placed elsewhere, excarnated elsewhere, and then bits of the bodies have gone. So often we don't find a whole person, but also we find more than people. We often find objects, we often find animal remains, plant remains, substances, clothing, you know. So when we, you know, all of those elements we're studying, not just a skeleton. So that's the first point. But even when we find a person, a articulated skeletonized human being, once live human being, it's never about that person. And this is where one of our biggest, most persistent myths we have in common, you know, common sort of media understandings of burial archaeology, is that we are digging up a person, almost like they tripped into the grave with all the things they happen to have on them. That is incredibly rare. And in fact, the only occasions where we have people fixed in time as they were in life are not funerals, are not burials. And the, you know, the disturbing and haunting, you know, examples of the Pompeii and Herculaneum human remains are, in ironically, not really mortuary archaeology, because then they've not been subject to a set of choices by living people about how to dispose of those remains, either where they died or near where they died, or transported those remains hundreds or thousands of miles. So in other words, you know, some of our best preserved human bodies from the past that capture our imagination are kind of not really the focus of what I look at. I'm more interested in the living people who made the choices about how that dead person was disposed of. And that means that what we're looking at is living people via the dead. It's almost the dead are part of the dynamic between us and past living people and the person that they're trying to dispose of. So the point I'm trying to get across in very long-winded way is the burial tells us about past living people and their relationships with a dead person, never about what are we going to stick in the grave. Well, he liked that tool, so let's just put that there. I mean, sometimes it may be as prosaic as that, but often it's a much more complicated selection process of objects. And this is our greatest nightmare when we kind of deal with media and popular engagement, because people want us to be able to say, when we find a burial, look, that was a person aged this age. You know, we can do osteological work on the skeleton, and we can say they were at this age, maybe this biological sex, as far as we can determine, and we can say something about the objects placed with them. But it's rarely, we're rarely just reading off an identity as they had it in life. There may be a complex process of perhaps giving them things that they never really used, but they hoped that maybe they would use in an afterlife or if they had continued to live. And if you look at any child grave today in a modern cemetery, tragic and sad as they are, you'll see objects that are way older than the child's death age. And that's because people are going back to the grave decades after that child has passed away and adding objects that that person may have used had they lived. And so that is a good example from the modern world. So you'll see a two-year-old, poor tragic two-year-old's grave, and you'll see toys meant for a teenager on there, or you know, a late, you know, sort of an 8-9-year-old, because that's their birthday age and that's a gift for them. And the same we're seeing in ancient graves. We're seeing a lot of objects that are brought by mourners and placed with the dead. So it's often a much more complex process. And the other answer to the question, if I can quickly add to that, is often we can't tell anything about the individual person by looking at one grave alone. And so a lot of the new discovery stories, you know, Roman burial found in seated position, warrior woman found in chambered grave in Viking site. These are inferences about individual graves, which are usually nonsense or at least dodgy, because you're trying to make a story up about a single individual. Often what mortuary archaeologists do is we try and look at a population level. We're looking at a bigger story. How did death rituals change over time? How do they change between areas, between regions, between parts of a cemetery? We can't often get their names. We can't often do this kind of CSI Gil Grissom moment where you suddenly envisage the whole of their life, you know.
Yeah, you mean with like funky techno music in the background as you glare meaningfully at a shard of bone and then determine everything.
That is what I do in my own mind, but of course, in the world of reality, which I also try to remember sometimes exists out there, no, that doesn't, of course, happen. Yeah, exactly. So I have the theme tune music and the Who goes on all the time. But so obviously, you've got the point. It's not
you don't
like
have
that.
A load of supermodels walking around the office either.
Well, that I've tried to arrange, but the university won't sort of fork out for that those additional.
It's not very woke, is it?
No, it's not. It's not at all. And I can't, you know, there's limits to what I can afford with my own salaries. I mean, there are priorities such as muffins and chocolate and things like that. They're higher priority than supermodels. So you know, within my job, you know, I have that in my mind that I am some kind of detective who can reconstruct everything. But in reality, what we're doing is working with fragments. We're working with parts of story, and we're looking for general patterns. We're not trying to work out exactly the details. Now, having said that, there are some really cool work you can do with the human body, and you can work out diseases they suffered during life, and maybe they had a really miserable time. You know, in their later life with this sort of spewing out wound that would have never healed. And you can say something about their lived experience, but often it's not, you don't have a named person. You don't know exactly what they felt about the politics or what they hoped their afterlife destination was going to be. You're working in much more general patterns. So we're looking at what's the difference to, you know, what's happening in late Roman cemeteries in terms of general changes, or what's happening with the rise of ancient civilizations and their changing burial rituals. We can't often get at those individual stories.
I have to say that one of the most charming habits I saw, if there can be such a thing when you're talking about dead children, I was in Sicily this year and I was hunting for some World War I graves. And all the children were buried together.
Yeah.
There's a whole section of the cemetery, and all of the children, local children that had died, they bury them together. So they're all together in the cemetery in a group, which I think is quite sweet.
And it's actually, that's a good example of what we're finding in the archaeological record often, is that the relationships in death aren't a mirror of life. Those children may have gone to school together, but it's very unlikely. You're looking at probably, unless you're talking about a disaster, like it's sort of an Abba Van type disaster, you're looking at children that died over 50, 100 years.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they went from like turn of the century up to now. But they just think it's nice if they're all together because they don't want them to be lonely.
Yes, exactly. And it creates, so what you're seeing in death is a community that is made up of perhaps multiple generations, fictive or, you know, created materially connections across the generations that never existed in the living world. And so you're constantly aware, you're dealing with this world of ideas, of imagined communities, past, present and future, when you're dealing with burial assemblages, whether you're dealing with cemeteries where they're all laid out in rows, or you're looking at sort of more complex burial plots. Many societies didn't have, you know, defined bounded cemetery spaces. They may have used multiple locations across a hillside, and you're realizing you're dealing with perhaps complex choices based on gender, age, social status, class, kinship groupings that, you know, we can't properly reconstruct, deciding where you get buried. And so it's a fascinating story, but it's not just about using the dead to work out about the living. It's about understanding the complex process in which these communities of the dead were being built up over time. And, you know, the choice to bury children in one particular location creates a different kind of environment than you would ever experience in the living world. And so there's this, it's a deceptive environment, but a fascinating set of data. And we can often pair it up with settlement evidence and realize that sometimes, the cemeteries aren't showing us the whole population. We're missing whole sections of the population. Perhaps they were disposing of them in ways that we can't find. And so we're never seeing the whole of the past. And we can often use a range of techniques in comparison with each other to sort of build up a story. So it's fun stuff. And of course, it allows us access not only to the distant past where we have no written records, but also to give us new stories about recent centuries.
You know, I can hear some osteoarchaeologists crying in their offices right now. I totally agree with what you said about the osteoarchaeology, that you can only tell a limited amount of things about these people. But I can just hear them saying, "No, but you can." But that's all I can hear.
Well, I'm not on the science side, so I'm not a lab coat wearing kind of sort of dude, and I think one of the things I do, I'm a bit of loggerheads with some of my more scientific colleagues, because the whole discourse of scientific analysis of ancient graves is a can do look at what we can find out, and a lot of them wouldn't deny what I'm saying either, but my whole take is much more of a yeah, but we've got to remember this and hang on. So I'm a bit more a killjoy mortuary archaeologist. That's doubly negative. It's more morbid enough being a mortuary archaeologist, but at least my white lab coat wearing science boffin pals say, "And look what we can find out," whereas I'm more of a yeah, but it's not that easy, is it? So I talk about doom and gloom, it gets even worse when you realize that it's all gone, it's only fragments. But seriously, it is exciting stories we can tell from different periods and times, and I'm only one archaeologist and everyone has a different perspective on this evidence, but I think I try to be a positive but cautious about what we can say about any particular period or time.
So religion for me is probably really, I find the burial of religion really, really interesting, because going back to my uni days, we would have these plans of various different cemeteries. And for example, Tim, I'm going to bring Tim back up into this conversation as always, because he was the man who taught me archaeology. And he'd be like, "Well, if you look at this cluster here and you look at the way it's facing north, south, I can never remember north, south, east, you can tell that it's a Christian burial."
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, all right, okay. So religion's a big thing. So there's lots of different dimensions to this, and depends on which sets up, depends on which part of the world, which archaeologists you talk to. And again, there's the can-do people who would tell you, we can say things about religion, and then there's, it's a bit difficult type people. So if you look at my period of interest, early medieval Europe, particularly early medieval Anglo-Saxon England, there's a whole debate going on about how much we can discern pre-Christian religion or not. Can we see Norse paganism and then before it, Anglo-Saxon paganism in the archaeological record? And I've been in different stages of my career, a can-do person. Yes, we can see aspects of this, and it's a bit difficult person. Because, of course, as I said, an individual isn't buried as they lived or even as they thought in life, and you're always dependent on your relatives about how you get buried. And often, you're not, in some societies, it's not your relatives that make the choice. It may be religious ritual specialists, or it may be your neighbours that have taken over the obligations of doing your funeral for you. So often, we can't always work out, it's from a pattern rather than that person was definitely a Roman Catholic, or that person was definitely in the 16th century a Protestant or something like that, an early Protestant. We can't always do it in such a simple way. And if you look at Christianity, for example, the diversity of ways in which burial takes place over the last two millennium is phenomenal in terms of burial location, inside churches when they get founded, outside churches. And also, there's lots of general cliches that, Christian burials have to be west-east. They tend to be, but we also find examples that are not. I've just been reading a new report of a Finnish cemetery where they found a whole series of church burials from the 17th, 18th century, I think it was, inside a church, but they're north-south. And the most likely reason, we don't actually have a clue why in Finland in the 16th, 17th century, or 17th century, I think it was, we'd have a north-south burial. It doesn't fit, I suspect. It's a prosaic thing. They didn't have room. They wanted it to align on the high altar, so they stuck it in north-south. But, we don't know. So there's all sorts of variations at different times, different places within a religious system where you can get buried in a very different way. Another good example in the late Middle Ages is we have lots of ecclesiastical ecclesiastical elite who were buried with grave goods. Something that if you talk to most people, say, well, Christians don't get buried with grave goods. Well, I'm afraid you talk to many 15th century priests or 14th, 15th century archbishops, they would get a mitre, they would get a chalice, they would get all of the symbols of their status would go into the grave, or some of them would. And so we have, a lot of within a religious system, you can have a lot of variety, is my point, a lot of synergy. And so we have examples, and again, because I've just been reading about Scandinavia, and particularly Sweden and also Finland. We have a lot of long after official Christian conversion in the, at the end of the first millennium AD and then through to the 12th, 13th century, as you go further east and north, you're finding, cremation burials continuing way late beyond official Christian conversion. And cremation is supposed to be out. It's not the thing you do. Priests are supposed to be telling you not to do it. But people are continuing to cremate relatives, clearly, generations after a formal Christian conversion. So my point is, That's me with my negative hat on. It can be a bit messy, religion, and people don't do what the priest tells them, and maybe the priest doesn't care. I can give you a modern example of that. Would you like a modern example?
Yeah, go on.
Right, well, I was doing a graveyard survey in a particular county of England, which will remain nameless, to preserve the anonymity of the vicar, and I said, so, vicar, we've been surveying your graveyard, and we've got these really interesting graves, but these recent sort of disturbances in this area here, oh, that's my cats and dogs. I said, I thought, you know, officially down the line, you know, cats and dogs, is the diocese, not supposed to, yeah, but they won't know. I said, okay. I said, well, at least you're not burying ponies or something in the cemetery, are you? No, I did that for my daughter, but I got into trouble.
He's really going to fuck with some archaeologist in 500 years' time, isn't he? Because unless someone leaves a note, I think what you need to do is roll up a note in a bottle and airtight it. This reflects nothing about society in the 21st century other than the fact that this vicar is a lunatic.
Well, I mean, he was a particularly eccentric character. He was responsible for multiple churches. And in those multiple churches, they will find the burial of a horse or a small horse. Badgers got at it and Defra were fining him. So they had to dispose of it in a legal fashion. For those listening, you can't just bury horses in your back garden, okay? It comes under Defra. It comes under animal disposal regulations. I don't know the details, but you will get prosecuted, okay? Actually, your own relatives, you can, as long as it doesn't interfere with water sources and it's a certain distance from neighbours' houses. But that's a different story. But my point is, I was just using it as an illustration of how someone who's supposed to be in a position of authority and knowing the legal status of his own burial patch was just basically inundating with his own family pets as part of a broader sort of, shall we say, eccentric way of interpreting his own job. And I think that's true of the past too, is that we anticipate that even within a Christian context, you'd have a lot of, shall we say, laxity in approaches to the regulations.
I'm going to ask you now, I'm not going to say body, because I don't want to restrict you. Now I know what mortuary archaeology is and I'm learning stuff. What is the most interesting site that you have excavated?
Okay, right, interesting, most interesting. Okay, well, there's a number of different options here. I will go with, can I do two?
Yes, because it's you, right. Howard, yes.
I thank you, because both involve bodies, but also absent bodies. Okay, my first one is I dug up with my a Swedish colleague, Dr. Martin Rundqvist. I excavated a 9th century Viking boat grave in Sweden, and that was a fun dig. With in the county of Östergötland, so it's sort of southern Sweden, is their only boat grave cemetery from the Viking Age. Well, we thought it was from the Viking Age, but no one had dug it. And the surface traces looked like boat-shaped depressions where they'd obviously built a cairn and then the boat had rotted away, leaving these kind of ghosts of boat-shaped ghosts, sort of like shallow depressions on the top of this ridge. But no one had excavated it. So our job was to excavate the smallest one where we'd do the least damage, to assess the date and character of the cemetery. And it's a good example, a little snapshot of why, we dig not to just, completely ransack a site, we dig to find out, because there's no point in protecting an ancient site if we don't know what it is. You know, so there's many a site in our landscape that we protect because we have a good understanding of what it is. Like, you can tell that's a 19th century part of a cemetery. There's massive great gravestones, so we're not going to dig there because we know we're going to find bodies, and we know, you know, unless there's a particular reason that a road's going to go through it or Tesco is going to be built, which is very unlikely over a cemetery, I'm just being silly, you're not going to actually, you know, disturb those remains. But when you go back in time, of course, we don't often have the surface traces, or if we do have surface traces, we don't know what it's marking. So this was a unique site for the county, and you know, we were given the task of, we were allowed to do a research excavation, because there's no point in preserving it if we don't actually know what it is. And yeah, we were able to confirm we had a small boat, 5 meters long, very badly preserved, looked like it had been robbed, but we did find evidence of the boat, the clench nails, very rusted clench nails where they put the boat together, and we also found these wonderful amber gaming pieces. They were beautiful, so carved out of amber, these sort of little, like little tea cakes you can get, like little chocolate tea cakes, you know, they're sort of that type of size, and they were probably Hrafnatal pieces, you know, the sort of Viking chess game. So they were amber gaming pieces, and found 23 of those. I also found some frost nails from horses' shoes, so horses could go on ice in winter, so you have little spikes you add to the bottom of the treads of horseshoes. So we found those, suggesting they probably sacrificed a horse. But unfortunately, we didn't find the bones, because the bones had been all eaten away. So we didn't find a human skeleton. We didn't find a horse sacrifice, because all of that bone had been leached away by 1,000 years plus of being in very shallow a grave. But we did find a knife, a bead, and some other elements that show that there had been a burial in this ship, but all we were finding was a very poorly preserved version of it. So that's my first, if I may, my first favourite site I've excavated with Swedish colleagues. And my second one, if I can, is a monument I was working on from 2010 to 2012, which is quite close to where I live and close to the University of Chester. It's at in Denbighshire, the Pillar of Eliseg. And this is a really unique 9th century fragment of an early medieval cross shaft placed on a Bronze Age burial mound. And long people have sort of speculated about why this Christian monument would be placed on an ancient burial mound at least 2,500 years older than it. And of course, no one really knew whether it was a Bronze Age mound. That was just a guess. So Bangor University and my university teamed up, and we did a 3 seasons of fieldwork with permission of CADU, who protect the site. And we excavated the Bronze Age mound, and we confirmed, we found secondary burials and cremation burials in Kiss. We confirmed it's a Bronze Age burial mound, but also we found interesting fragments of the story of the Christian early medieval monument on this pillar, with Britain's longest early medieval Latin inscription on a monument, commemorating the kings of Powys, who are basically the 9th century enemies of the Mercians, and who are building their Offa's Dyke and Watts Dyke to the east. You know, these are the Welsh dynasty who are sort of struggling to maintain their independence against big bully boy neighbours in the early Middle Ages. And they put their cross on top of this ancient mound, we think, as a way of sort of claiming the past, of claiming the land, when they were sort of surrounded on all sides, both by Welsh rivals and Anglo-Saxon rivals, by more powerful kingdoms. So they were sort of really drawing symbolically on the past with this monument to sort of define themselves. But anyway, there's a much bigger story I could tell you about that. But I can't really. It's a bit of a toss-up between Scamby, the boat grave cemetery I excavated, and the Pillar of Eliseg. Because while we didn't find we didn't find a skeleton, we did find some cremation burials from the early Bronze Age that proved that the mound was far older than the Christian cross put on top of it.
I like the boat burial, I think, the most. That one's drawn me.
Wait, say that again.
The boat burial?
No, the whole sentence.
I like the boat burial the best.
Oh my God, she has just ranked boaty stuff above everything else. Oh, Kate Jameson's heart is going to break when she hears that. The weir is literally going to break down.
I've lost track now. I don't.
Alina is famous for her total indifference to what she refers to as boaty stuff.
Oh,
other people
right.
refer to it as naval history. To the point where we have taught her this year the difference between a ship and a boat, and that a submarine is not a boat, and that was as far as we got. But I feel like we've just taken a mass. This is a Neil Armstrong moment.
Well, I think if you're going to break through into naval history, starting with the Vikings is pretty good place to start. So
I've got to ring Giles after this, Alina. Giles has kindly sent her a collection of naval books to get her shit together.
So, I can't believe you tricked me. What a cruel trick to me.
You said it.
No, it's because I was taken by the amber pieces.
So shiny things, not the boat.
The shiny things, but I also think it's really interesting the kind of grave goods that were found.
Absolutely,
absolutely. That's a good way of digging yourself out of that grave. But the amber is wonderful because it kind of glows in sunlight. It's a wonderful substance, and so I must admit, I've dug up some interesting stuff in my time, but that was one of the top finds, because it was just, they are just such a wonderful, I don't know, it's just a difficult to describe. I mean, you know, everyone's probably encountered a bit of amber that's, you know, as a bit of jewellery, but these were just big chunks, massive chunks, you know.
Well, in my head now, I'm thinking, can we drill in, get mosquitoes, DNA, dinosaurs?
Viking dinosaur DNA, it's going to happen. I can see the film.
Where your mind goes, Alex, it just amazes me sometimes. I love it.
If there's a T-Rex, I'm there. I am an 8-year-old boy when it comes to dinosaurs. You've touched on this throughout, but how does mortuary archaeology interact with other types of archaeology? You've mentioned the science-y boffins and things, but how do you essentially leech off each other to further your academic gains?
We are. I mean, archaeology is one big leechy subject, it must be said. Archaeology is, I mean, there's different ways you can look at it. I mean, archaeology is a bit of geography, a bit of history, a bit of anthropology, you know, a bit of sociology. It's a bit of everything. Or you could say, if you want to be really haughty about it, and I do say this to historians all the time, so I don't see why I should be shy. You know, history is just a specialised form of archaeology where you're mainly looking at the written sources, which is a small subset of a broader story of human history. So I shall now run away as you rant at me. No.
So what is it that historians say about the archaeologist, Selena?
Go on.
Yeah, I can't remember. We've had this before. Something along the lines of sitting in a hole while someone does the real work, I think.
Yeah, do you know what?
It's like the Army versus the Air Force thing, isn't it?
It is. There's a healthy... I mean, I'm in a history and archaeology department, so we have... a healthy banter is the phrase I call it when I'm not swearing.
It's just bants. It's japes.
how we laugh as we throw things at each other down the corridor. No, it's good fun. No, but I mean, we are connected to many other different types of other subjects, first point. And second point is we are connected to many other types of archaeology. So mortuary archaeology could be seen as a sub-discipline when we look at death. But of course, you know, you cannot dig a settlement from later prehistory and expect to not find, you're going to find bits of human remains in some periods and places. You know, settlements are one of the key places, or next to settlements are one of the key places that people have buried the dead. So there's not even a spatial division often between burial archaeology and settlement archaeology. You're just doing archaeology and you will find bits of evidence of people's lives and people's mortality. You know, that's the point I want to make in terms of where we dig. You cannot be a mortuary archaeologist and expect to only find skeletons, or expect to only survey gravestones. You've got to think about, if you're doing a survey of a graveyard, you've also got to look perhaps at the architecture of the church, or, you know, you'll be looking at the local settlement. So, you know, landscape archaeology, settlement archaeology, mortuary archaeology, they're all a mess overlapping with each other. And then there's various sub-disciplines we use. There's a massive revolution going on at the moment of ancient DNA work, which is obviously overlapping with mortuary archaeology, and mortuary archaeology is overlapping with stable isotope analysis, so the bone chemistry work that's being done, so we can hopefully find out more about where people came from as opposed to where they were buried, which is giving us a whole new, you know, ancient migrations were completely out of the conversation 20, 30 years ago. It was all, oh no, you can't talk about migration. Of course, now we've got, you know, evidence of people moving around in the ancient world, in prehistory, in the Middle Ages, you know, coming out of our ears in terms of bone chemistry analysis, you know, because we can see the difference between the teeth and where people grew up in terms of their local diet and the local environment versus where they ended up being buried. So we, you know, there's so many sub-disciplines of interaction between our mortuary archaeology and other kinds of scientific analysis and the questions we're asking. So, and you know, to be absolutely honest about this banter with history, you know, often a lot of the subjects were overlapping. So one of the things I'm particularly interested in at the moment is war memorials, you know, which is a massive area of study for historians. But of course, it's an area I've published on from an archaeological take on particular war memorials and mortuary landscape.
Must write for the Great War Group, because Owen Rees did like the historian ancient connotations of modern war remembrance. But yeah, I'm gonna nag you to do an article for
I was happy to. I mean, it's really interesting, because I mean, I when I started going to the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire, and I was realized how much of it is built drawing on prehistoric and ancient allusions, and that's a, you know, that's a naughty site, that's a millennium site, that's a 1996-7 startup, and then 2000, and it's stacked full of it. And of course the Armed Forces Memorial is designed, apparently it doesn't, but it apparently is supposed to look like the barrows around Stonehenge and Avebury and the Henge, and it does, I mean, from an archaeological point of view it looks nothing of the kind, but that's the inspiration of the architect. And there's a solar alignment, it's apparently inspired by Maze Howe, the Neolithic passage grave from Orkney. So our modern landscape is replete with sort of prehistoric and medieval and ancient fantasies that are drawn from our ancient archaeological discoveries. So if you put it this, you can put it in different ways, but you could say at one level, we're archaeologists are responsible for all the crazy war memorials that we're around us in our landscape. And not crazy or interesting, should we say, this will be more or less derogatory. You know, we're you know, at the results of ancient times, the results of our discoveries are interplaying with our sort of various visions of colonial, imperial and military pasts. So I think you know, we can't stay out of those conversations. There's a lot of overlap.
My next question is, we're going to dabble a bit of public archaeology, and obviously when you're stuck in that lecture hall with your lovely lecturer, this subject comes up quite a lot, doesn't it? Ethics and things like that. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so this is an area I've been increasingly interested in. It's never, you can't get into mortuary archaeology, I mean, without it being there. So it's not as if it's a revelation for me. When I was doing my doctoral research at the University of Reading back in the late 90s, can anyone remember 2019, let alone the late 90s? I don't know. But anyway, you know, back in the day, you know, you start to do a piece of research on mortuary archaeology, you're aware of the ethical debates. And from the 80s and 90s, you know, British archaeology, obviously slower in the uptake than in Australia, New Zealand, North America, but we were aware, you know, that digging up the dead is not a neutral space. It's not a, no, they're there, they're research materials, let's just dig. You know, it's not a new revelation. And so, but in the last 20 years, this topic has, you know, the number of ways it interfaces with our work has been, it's just exploded in so many ways. So that first of all, there's the fact that the value we put on the historic landscape, whether it's Stonehenge, whether it's historic battlefields or shipwrecks, can I bring in shipwrecks? You know, whether it's on land or sea, you know, the value we put on them is related to the presence of human remains or the fact they were places where people died, you know, and are memorialized. So there's an ethical, you know, our values, the very value we put on ancient monuments and sites is related to the presence of the dead. It's been a long debate about how and should we display the dead in museums, store them in museums and in university collections. There's a whole international debate and ongoing controversies about repatriation and reburial of human remains and sacred objects that were, you know, not only those that are robbed and plundered in colonial times, but also ones that are still on display and debated, you know, and discovered quite recently. So even in the last decade, we had the big neo-pagan controversy about Avebury's Alexander Keeler Museum and their claims for the child skeleton on display there to be reburied, you know, because of not an ancestral but a spiritual link between pagan people today and those Neolithic ancestors. We have, you know, another example on the headlines recently is the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford has finally, I would say finally because that's my opinion, removed their Ecuadorian shrunken heads from display, as well as other human remains such as a child Egyptian mummy. So these are, this is not new. Some of my younger scholars, colleagues seem to think this is a new revelation that we suddenly discovered that these objects in museums have a colonial history. And, you know, with 2020 and the aftermath of George Floyd and so on, this is, you know, an accelerated debate, and rightly so, but it's not new. And it's been an ongoing topic of discussion. You know, then we have another area of ethics, is the fact that as long alongside our work with mortuary remains, there's a huge illicit trade in antiquities, much of it robbed from graves, you know, not only in the from the 19th, early 20th century, ongoing robbing and ransacking of cultural sites around the world, facilitated in war zones, especially, you know, from Iraq, Syria, you know, and archaeologists have not only been lobbying and trying to participate in, you know, trying to stop and this happening, but also in, you know, we are complicit in it in some ways, and often indirectly. And a recent example I waded in on last year was on the UK auctioneer Hansen's selling, putting on sale early Anglo-Saxon artifacts and human remains. You know, a lot of archaeologists, one of the rare points where I agree with most of my archaeology colleagues, where we all agreed on social media, this was a moment to make a point of objecting to this sale. So, you know, it's not just those kind of ethical issues, though. It's also that it links to heritage tourism. You know, this year, joking aside about 2020, don't open another Egyptian sarcophagus, you know, Egypt has been powering on, you know, with massive public media spectacles of their excavations and displaying human remains, because it's linked to their flailing heritage tourism industry, you know, with coronavirus and with terrorist attacks and all sorts. They want to promote Egypt through sarcophagi and mummies, and so there's that dimension. But I also the other areas I'm also interested in are things like how our popular culture is increasingly archaeological, mortuary archaeological. So I've actually written an article about the TV show Vikings and how many funerals in it there are, and how they're all different. And while some of them are inspired by fantasy saga literature, a lot of it is also coming from archaeological sources. So, you know, you watch a TV show a decade ago, or 15, 20 years ago, you maybe see one or two funerals. Now, our TV, our historic dramas, no matter how fictional, fantastical, they're packed full of funerals. And so this is a real area of interaction with mortuary archaeology, is that we have this sort of pop culture funerals that we, from, and Game of Thrones is something I've also commented on, with so many from George R. R. Martin's fantasy medieval world is packed full of cremations, but within a sort of late medieval sort of fantasy genre. And so that's a really interesting area of intersection with my work on cremation practices. So I find it very interesting. You know, it's not about, oh, he got it wrong, but it's about, what does that tell us about our relationship with, you know, imagine past funerals, that we pack our TV fiction with these funeral scenes. So I'm really interested in those kind of issues as well. So I suppose there's the ethical issues of what we do with the dead and how archaeologists work with the dead, but also the broader political, social context in which we work, and the pop culture is really fascinating too. Yeah, so it's a real rich field, and also I've edited four books on this, or three books, and I've got one conference forthcoming. So it's an area I'm really interested in, multiple angles. And I've also done a lot of blog posts on The Walking Dead and the mortuary archaeology in The Walking Dead, a fictional, you know, post-apocalyptic world, but where funerals seem to really matter. You know, how you bury people and the choices that fictional world presents about how we deal with the dead. So that's why I made the point at the very beginning about mortuary archaeology. Yes, sure, it's about digging up the past and learning about past societies, but it's also about a conversation about what we think about our mortality and about what we think about our future relationships with the dead in the digital world and in into the 21st century and beyond.
Howard, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about mortuary archaeology, because we are a depressing couple of buggers as well, and we love this stuff. It's absolutely fascinating. There's so much more to it, isn't there, than digging a hole and going, whoops, I've hit a skeleton.
Yeah, it's good stuff. There's so many angles to it. I love it.
Join us tomorrow when Mary Ann Lund will be with us, and we'll be talking all about Renaissance mental health. So we'll be talking about what they termed melancholy. It's a really interesting chat, so don't miss out on that one.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack, and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year, and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join There's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.